I'm Francesca Happe. I'm Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College London, and I do research about autism. I've been interested in a whole range of different aspects of autism over the years. I've been working in this area for 30 years, so I've been interested in, I suppose, broadly speaking, how people on the autism spectrum see, think about, process the world differently from neurotypical people. And that's ranged from thinking about understanding the social world to the beautiful eye for detail that can be seen often in autism. And most recently, I've become worked up about groups that are neglected in autism research, particularly women and particularly older adults aging in autism. It often comes as a surprise to people that most autistic people are adults, and God willing, most autistic people will live most of their lives as adults. And we know that the population in general is trending towards living longer, more of the population being elderly, but nobody seems to be doing research really about what that means for autistic people. And it's a really important question. It's a really interesting question, because we just don't know how the brain, how the mind, how quality of life does change or could change in older age. We have every reason to think that living a life that's very stressful because of the demands of a neurotypical world will take a toll on physical health. And there's some evidence that most physical health conditions are worse or at a higher rate in autistic adults. But to look at those who are 50, 60, 70, 80, I think is really important. We have one study which we haven't published yet that suggests that while neurotypical or non-autistic adults who are 60 or 70 are less good at understanding social situations, at least the sort of social situations we ask them about, than neurotypical adults who are 20 or 30 years old, that's not true for autistic adults. The older autistic adults haven't suffered any decrement to their social understanding. And so whether that's a sort of protective effect, maybe from talking to autistic adults, the fact that they have to work so hard to understand neurotypical interaction and to try and cope with the neurotypical world, you could imagine that's like brain training. Basically, you're doing brain training, you're doing the equivalent of doing crosswords and Sudoku and so on, just to cope with a neurotypical world. And you're doing that every day of your life. And maybe that gives you some cognitive reserve in older age. There are other explanations as well, but I think that's an interesting one. Mental health in autism is a really, really major issue. And I think that's for a lot of reasons. You can immediately see that the strain that living in a neurotypical world puts on an autistic person in itself is a mental health risk. We know that feeling isolated, being discriminated against, being traumatized by your experiences of the world are all, of course, bad for mental health. And no surprise that autistic people have much higher rates of anxiety and depression and sadly suicide than non-autistic people. And then you can add on other layers to the difficulty. If we make it difficult for autistic people to communicate, if we make doctors and GPs, surgeries, hostile environments, then we're going to have a problem of not quickly reporting your difficulties, not being able to bring your difficulties to the attention of those, even if those people want to or can help. And we also know that some autistic people experience pain differently. So again, it may be hard for them to know, let alone communicate, what they're experiencing. And we know that early intervention in all these health matters is much better than late treatment. So for all these reasons, it's really important to know more. And it's really important, I think, to challenge the stereotype that, you know, well, anxiety is part of autism, or social anxiety is part of autism. Our work has shown that social anxiety is not part of autism. It's something that some autistic people live with, and they don't need to live with it if we give the right interventions and if we make their social experiences more positive through the right accommodations in the world. So it looks to us like social anxiety in autism is just like social anxiety outside autism. and you can treat it as well. And we shouldn't be accepting it as part and parcel of the autism. We shouldn't accept anxiety and suffering as part and part of autism. It's something that grows out of the interaction between an autistic person and the demands put on them and the acceptance or not given to their differences. So I think there's a lot of reason for optimism that we can learn how to adapt which interventions, which treatments, which therapies work for anxiety and depression and obsessive compulsive disorder and ADHD and all these other things that can make life really difficult. And those things, much more than the autism itself, are what makes life hard for autistic people. So if we can address those, we can make a real difference. We don't need to find the genes that are involved in autism. We just need to look at what makes life difficult for autistic people and listen to what they want and need to make that change. And that's a very tractable problem. I think it's incredibly important to involve autistic people in all stages of research, from deciding what the important questions are to thinking about the theoretical underpinnings of the work we plan, to thinking about how to address those questions, to looking at the data and helping to interpret it with non-autistic researchers, to dissemination. So this is something that's changed enormously in the 30 years I've been in autism research. When I started in autism research, autism was defined and diagnosed very, very narrowly. And most of the people diagnosed and most of the participants in research, they were children, first of all. They were often minimally verbal. They typically had intellectual disability as well as autism. And the idea that you would involve them in deciding how to do the research was completely, you know, not on the horizon. But having said that, even as a PhD student, I met Temple Grandin, and it was clear that here was an autistic researcher, woman, academic, designer, a brilliant, brilliant person. But it's taken a long time, I think, for researchers to wake up to the fact that it isn't enough to ask autistic experts to help you know how to design a questionnaire or what kind of rating scale is going to be most appropriate, but that really it should be co-design with autistic people from the start. And I think the challenge now, apart from embedding that and getting old dinosaurs like me to, you know, take on new working practices, which of course is a joy to do because we have wonderful young PhD students and early career researchers to update us and to inform us and to make us passionate about those things. But the battle now, I think, is to make sure that all voices are included. And how do we include in participatory research models those who are minimally verbal or who communicate in ways that neurotypicals aren't used to listening to? How do we represent the views and concerns of all the different stakeholders? So parents of very young children, elderly people on the autism spectrum, those who have intellectual disability, those who don't. Getting all those voices included, I think, is the next challenge. So we got interested and concerned quite a few years ago by the possibility that autistic people would not only be exposed to traumatic and upsetting and harmful events more than people in the general population, but that they might also be more vulnerable to that translating into something like post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic intrusive memories and nightmares, re-experiencing and flashbacks. And that was because research with non-autistic people was suggesting that some of the predisposing factors for PTSD include being a very visual thinker or thinking in a visual way around the traumatic event. And also maybe something like an eye for detail or tending to hold on to a fragmented memory rather than being able to tell a story about what you'd experienced. And both of those characteristics are very relevant when we think about autism. And so at that point seemed really important and interesting to see whether this hunch was right, that the experience of trauma and that converting into something like PTSD was at higher rates in autism. And then something worrying happened, which was that the new diagnostic and statistical manual in the States, DSM-5 in 2013, changed the criteria for PTSD. So that to get a diagnosis, you now had to have experienced or seen a life-threatening event. And we were instantly worried about that. And this is Freya Rumbold, who was working with me at the time, and myself. We were instantly worried about that because we knew from talking to autistic friends and other people that they were often traumatized by things that didn't seem to others to be life-threatening. So somebody who takes the same bus to work every day, and then their bus goes on a diversion without telling them and puts them down in the middle of nowhere. And they never want to go on a bus again. And they have re-experiencing of the terror of that bus letting them down and taking them where they didn't want to go. So we've done some research now, which is in progress, looking at traumatic stress disorder symptoms following typical traumas, the sorts that DSM-5 would recognise, like being in a car crash, and atypical traumas, which very sadly in the case of our autistic sample is often bullying, but in some cases is also contact with mental health professionals. And we find exactly the same rates of conversion to post-traumatic stress disorder type symptoms following typical and atypical traumas. So about 40% of the people in our sample, all of whom said they'd experienced a trauma of some sort, about 40% would meet criteria on our brief screener of PTSD. And so what we're trying to do now is get a change made to the DSM-5 so that autistic people and those who experience trauma in situations that are not objectively life-threatening but are perceived as horrific and life-threatening will still be eligible to be diagnosed and therefore receive treatment, because we know there are lots of good treatments for PTSD and many of them are highly accessible to autistic people, but we fear they may be put out of the reach of autistic people because of this difference. People quite often ask me why I started getting interested in autism, and it's hard for me to answer, because why does one thing fascinate you and another thing doesn't? It wasn't for family reasons. I don't have a family connection with autism. I learned about autism as a student, and it seemed to me utterly fascinating that some children and adults experience the world so differently. And then I was lucky enough to find in a secondhand bookshop in Brighton the book called The Siege by Clara Claiborne Park, which was, I think, the first parental account, first person account as a parent of a child with autism, and also a book written by the head teacher of a special school. And both of these books I found incredibly fascinating. And then I was lucky enough as an undergraduate to get a volunteer research job in one summer holidays with Neil O'Connor and Artie Hermelin. And they were, I think, the founding grandmother and grandfather of a sort of cognitive psychological understanding of autism in the UK. One of the things they did was demonstrate, if you can imagine back in the 50s and 60s, that no child was ineducable. There was the idea before that you should make a division. You found out, was this child able to be educated or not? Can you imagine that some children were already thought to be not worth trying to educate? So Neil and Artie showed that every child was educable, that every child and young person and adult eventually was also able to be included in research. There wasn't anybody we couldn't work with and try and find out more with. So they were very, very inspiring. And that was my first experience of autism in real life, not on the page. And it blew me away. It blew me away. If you can imagine back in the late 80s, I went around the country to special schools and to sheltered accommodation to test the memory abilities of autistic savants who were mnemonists, who had amazing memories in areas that they were really passionate about, that they really cared about. So I would go up to Liverpool and test some particular young man who had memorised all the bus routes in his area. And then I would go to Sybil Elgar School and I would test some young girl who knew, had an encyclopedic knowledge of birds of prey. And it was extraordinary. But it was also very upsetting, because it was the first time I had gone in, and I was going in alone, to these special schools and settings for people, as I mentioned, most autistic people then also with intellectual disability, many with very little language that anyone could understand as communication. And I thought at that time, autism is the most fascinating thing, but I'm not ready. I can't process that yet. But then a PhD place came up with Uta Frith, and a very lovely professor who I was going to stay and do a PhD with about ordinary children's mathematics said, "You're interested in autism, aren't you? You should go and talk to Uta." So I went to talk to her, and I realised after about half an hour that this was actually an interview, not just a chat. But again, I, at the end of that, I realised, no, autism is so fascinating. I can't walk away from this. And I was so lucky to do a PhD with Uta. And although it was really scary to come to London and go and work in that MRC unit that was full of these brilliant people, I thought, you know, I might not be bright enough for them, but I'll do the best PhD I can do if I go there. And I never regretted it. I moved to London. I lived in a basement room that didn't have a window. And I thought of my lovely room in Oxford, where I could have been with my boyfriend at the time. And I didn't regret it for a minute because it was so fascinating. And one of the good things Uta made me do was from the first day of my PhD to go and work once a week at an autism special school, in fact, at Sybil Elgar School, and just to be a pair of hands in the classroom. And that was really, really valuable. And autism never stopped being fascinating to me. There are lots of things that fascinate me, but just fascinating. And my daughter recently went and got her work experience in Queen's Mill School. And she said afterwards, you know, I don't really like children, but I like autistic children. And I said, yes, I agree. Autistic people are just so much more interesting. So much more interesting. And I still feel that. And every autistic friend I have is, you know, is a privilege to me. I've had a wonderful career so far, working on and with and around autism. And I'd encourage any early career researcher to follow what they find fascinating. Personally, I think there are some areas that are really neglected in autism research. I would like to see much more research with autistic people with intellectual disability, people to use new technologies to include those who are thought to be minimally verbal. And I think things like motor difficulties, developmental coordination disorder, language impairment, these things as co-occurring difficulties in autism are hugely neglected. And I'd still love to see somebody crack the puzzle of sensory fascinations and sensitivities that are such a big part of most autistic people's lives, but I think we still don't understand. And that would be a lovely area to work hand in hand with autistic researchers and consultants and really make a difference in our understanding and in quality of life.